All right. Hi, everybody. Thanks for coming.
We really appreciate you showing up, both with so many choices and on a day that's so wet. So we really appreciate it. Hi, Thor.
All right.
Yeah, nice to see you. Yeah, thanks for coming. So we want you all to imagine that you've just received a company-wide email about an urgent all-hands meeting. It's happening right now. And as you walk towards the conference room, you know something's up. You sit down and a buzz of curiosity fills the air. Your CEO stands up in front of the group and waits for things to quiet down.
I have some important news. It looks like we're going to say yes to a purchase offer from Yo-Yo Dyne. We've been in conversation with them for the past several months, and it's become clear that we share many of the same values and with the synergies, they're incredible synergies.
Okay, freeze frame. Now, everyone in this imaginary room is going to be hit by the news in their own way. As a founder, you may be really excited to close the deal, but you might also be worried, like, did I just sell my soul to the devil? And how is my team going to receive this? You know, are people going to be excited or are people going to be frustrated? And unless you're one of the few people who was actually involved in the negotiation, you're a little bit scared, like, how's my job going to go? Is my team going to stay together? How's it going to be for me? As an early member of the team, you might be thinking about, like, where's my technology going to go? Like, are these guys going to hold it with the same love and excitement that I've been treating it with for the last months or years? And if you're a more recent hire, you might just be wondering if you're going to keep your job. There will be people outside the room, so there will be the people who actually saw this company and the promise of bringing them in. And they'll be both excited that they finally got the negotiations over with and got the deal done, but also be a little bit worried about how it's going to go. So all of those people are now sharing a destiny. And happiness is going to mean something different, potentially, for each one of them. Now let's resume.
I want you to know that Yo-Yo Dyne has agreed that we'll continue to manage everything as we have been in the foreseeable future, and that as much as possible, things are going to stay the same. I'm really appreciative of all the hard work that you've done to get us this far, and I couldn't be more excited that we all have the opportunity to join the Yo-Yo Dyne team.
Okay, so of course, things aren't going to stay the same. Some of the changes will be totally predictable, but some will be utterly surprising. And we asked to host this core conversation after realizing that so few acquisitions go really, really well. Mostly there's a lot of horror stories out there. But when they do go well, it's really magical. And so we wanted to see what we could do to help tip the scales in favor of acquisitions going better. Yeah, oh, hi. I'm Marcy Swenson, and I'm an executive coach who works with startups and a prior co-founder of a handful of companies.
I'm James Holm. I actually have never been a CEO. I'm a product designer at Google, which was actually acquired, which is by way of an acquisition of a company called Meta.
Yeah. And a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, James Holm and I worked together in the dot-com days. We both were at Critical Path, which went public and acquired 11 companies in 15 months for $4.2 billion, which is the cost of Google acquiring two YouTubes. So we're by no means experts on this topic, but we both had some experiences, and we thought this conversation would be interesting and really something worth talking about.
So we're not experts, but we've kind of seen four things that sort of stand out to us as things that affect these acquisitions. So one, great acquisitions communicate a vision of the future together. So both teams are kind of responsible for making this vision cohesive and kind of crafting it.
Yeah, and I want to add, ideally, you know, the sort of mock exercise we're doing is you're in the room and the company has just been acquired. But ideally, a bunch of work has gone on behind the scenes beforehand. You really want to make sure that your vision is aligned with the company you're buying or the company that is buying you. And this would be a good time to throw in a quote from David Lawley. He's the VP of Corporate Development at Google. He's responsible for, sort of at a high level, all of their acquisitions. Here's what he says about alignment. The most important thing I look for is alignment between what the entrepreneur wants to do with their product and their company and what Google wants to do. If there's perfect alignment, then it has a very high chance of success. And if there's not, we should not be doing it.
So point two is related to that to some degree. In any acquisition, there are a lot of mysteries involved. So you just heard this news from your CEO. All these questions have gone through your head. You really don't know what the future is going to look like. The quicker you can resolve those mysteries, the better for everybody involved.
Yeah. In the sort of mock exercise that we started, we would just be launching into the phase of everyone hearing the news and sort of the integration starting. And at that point, probably the most important thing is to really take great care of people, you know, actually on both sides, and to sort of clear up all those mysteries. And I'll throw a point back to the vision, which I forgot. In addition to creating alignment, what you want to test for beforehand is to make sure the two companies' values and culture are well enough aligned so that people will feel some sense of comfort. It doesn't have to be perfect, but it has to be close enough.
So, and point three, great acquisitions acknowledge that no matter how much care goes into it, it's going to be hard, right? There's going to be time and effort, emotional impact involved. And pretending otherwise is really disingenuous, right? And it kind of alienates both teams, and that's, you know, that's a challenge as well. Number four, great acquisitions broaden the reach of both the company and the individuals that work there. It gave them access to markets, resources, customers, knowledge, and opportunities that they wouldn't have otherwise had. MetaWeb is a really great example of this. We were trying to build a giant database of every person, place, or thing in the world. Really, really tough to do as a startup, but working as part of Google, that's actually something that looks like it's possible. And then personally, you know, I'm no longer working with the MetaWeb team, I'm working on search results. So it's, you know, the design work that I was doing before was DC by a couple thousand people, now it's hundreds of a million people, and that's really exciting. So that kind of broad reach is something that can be great out of the position.
Yeah, so just to review the points that we just talked about. First, you really want to see that there's alignment. There's alignment in the vision going forward, and there's alignment in values and in culture. And that's kind of before you even sign the deal. Then you're in a phase where really it's going to be kind of tender for the company being acquired. And so that's the point where it's really important to take care of people. You know, at that point, it's really all about how can you welcome the newly acquired company in and really help them know things are going to be okay. And if you do those two things really well, you've got a shot at broadening the reach for both companies and potentially for individuals, like what happened for James. So we're really curious to see who's in the room and kind of kick this off. We wanted to set the stage and give some ideas, but this is really about you, both the information that you have to share and also the questions that you have. So we're really curious. Who in the room has been at a company that has been acquired? Show of hands. Awesome. And if you were on the acquiring team, the team that actually went out and did the diligence and acquired somebody, put your hand up again. Yeah, so a couple of those. And who here has been at a company that has been acquired?
Isn't that what you asked?
That was the first one. That was the first question. Yeah.
Thank you.
Sorry.
Help me out. What's the reverse of that? I got flummoxed.
Acquirer.
The acquirer. Okay.
And bold.
Great.
Great.
So how did it go? Here actually feels like they came away from that hack.
So here's the works of the company that they're talking about.
So no hands were happy.
I'm no hand.
Yeah.
As well as companies that are when they acquired some kind of special case. Yeah, I mean they're rough bumps, they're so far so not thrilled with them, but we're all happy.
So for those of you who weren't, like, what are some of the things that could have been different about how the deal was approached, how the communication went, how the vision could have been better aligned, and what actually could have been different?
why does everyone need to have this company? And that they were the one that got the better deal or whatever. And for me, that's really demoralizing me. It's like, well, why did I spend all this time trying to, A, recommend a company that I knew was a good fit, and then B, we bought the one that we all knew was a bad fit, but we're not really sure why. So that's super frustrating. On the other hand, I was at a company once that was acquired by Amazon. This was 8 years ago or 10 years ago, so I don't expect this to happen again. But
yeah.
Jeff Bezos came personally, and it was a 22-person company. And he personally flew down to San Francisco from Seattle and welcomed us into Amazon and closed on what the acquisition was in Montreal. So to start off on that foot, it really felt good.
Yeah. What else went well in that acquisition?
Almost
like,
nothing.
Almost nothing. Okay.
In my opinion, and I hate to say this, but in which is a little bit why this conversation is so interesting to me, I think that 90% of all acquisitions fail. And I think that they fail for many of the reasons that you just mentioned. Mm-hmm. Lack of cultural fit, lack of technology fit, and nobody really holding the hand of the small company as the ultimate company. And I'm sure you felt a lot of this when it's Google, yeah. Right? This little company is used to just getting things done, And then to get into this mega machine of a monolithic company where it's like, here's the HR system, and here's the IT system, and here's the... And it's difficult for a small company to have an issue to that while they're also kind of building their business.
Yeah, that makes total sense. James, can you speak to that at all? Like,
yeah, I mean, so
MetaWeb got enfolded by Google, so
yeah,
that's
so,
like little and big.
Right. So it's, there were definitely places where that wasn't a huge challenge, right? I think that Google does that particular thing a little better than most, and that addresses kind of that exact issue, right? There's a team that's kind of responsible for the logistical side of it, and then someone who's completely separate, who's essentially a sponsor, right? And it's the person who's responsible for sort of seeing the vision fit, right? And the conversations that you're having with both of those people are really different. But it's still, you know, it's still a huge jump, right? And it's, you know, it took a good solid 6 months before it felt like it was solid ground. I feel like a lot of companies never kind of regained that ground. So,
one of the companies that eBay just bought, they're late on one of their deliverables, and I'm not going to name the company. And basically they said everybody's working nights and weekends and all vacations are canceled until that thing gets out. And I'm like, oh,
yeah.
Meetings will continue until morale improves.
Right.
That's a good way to do it.
Yeah, so that's not going to be successful, right? Like, you can't feel successful in that environment.
Okay.
How old is that acquisition?
A year.
Yeah, so that's really early to have that kind of expectation of success, right?
Yeah. About 50% of the
Yeah.
And it speaks to one of the experiences I had at Critical Path, which is over time we figured out anytime you acquire a smaller company, you're going to slow them down. So the roadmap that they handed you when you said, ooh, we're really excited about acquiring you, that's going to be blown just by the fact that they're going to be integrated into a whole new company.
Yeah.
So unless you're absolutely leaving someone alone, and it's almost impossible to do,
right.
Everything is going to take more time, everything is going to take more energy, and there's sort of this emotional hit. It's like people in an acquired company almost go through the stages of grieving, where you know there's disbelief. I'm not remembering exactly what they are, but at the end is acceptance. So there's this sort of story arc of people going, whoa, this is new information. This is not what I wanted necessarily to have happen. And then they sort of, if they're treated well, they get to, oh, okay, this might be an interesting place to be. All right, what possibilities are here?
Well, and that notion of the team being able to stay together, right? Like I actually think the acquisition that I'm aware of that happens is that they've really kept their teams not isolated, but really cohesive whole on the remote and worked around ways that they integrate the whole team as opposed to individuals from the team. And that strategy actually seems to eliminate some of the emotional aspects of it. So that's really positive.
Mm-hmm. Kind of the counter example of that for me.
Yeah.
Was that my team was kept alone. For no one ever told us. Because we were so alone, no one ever told us what the point of the whole thing was. And we didn't know it. At no level of my company, we weren't able to go out and find out what there was out there.
Right.
So it was kind of this entire informational black hole that we jumped out to.
Yeah.
And
So this is an example of you didn't have the vision conversation.
Yeah, sure.
There was no moment where there was a shared vision that you had, right? And that's really like, that really seems like it must have happened before, you know, before you've moved to offices, before you've even announced to the team, right? Like, how do you tell the story of your futures together, right?
And the fact that conversation can happen, I kind of almost wish that they taken half our team and moved them into some other part of the company and given us half more people just so that we can do it in some sort of cultural information.
Sure. What you're doing and what the acquiring company is doing very different?
The acquiring company is 4,000 people, we're 30 people, so yes, it was different-ish. But
sure.
Not that different, but so.
Yeah.
The same city though?
Same, their headquarters, they had an office in San Francisco.
Our problem is we were in New York and we're quite a company in Chicago.
Yeah.
I just moved out to Chicago, but not many people can just go there. So.
Sure, the geographic challenge, that's a big one, for sure. And it's a really hard one to get around, right? Because you don't want to make your whole team move. But
and the video conferencing, whatever, none of that really works.
No.
People just go back and forth, but we're trying, but it's still going to struggle.
Do you have a plan for how to adjust with that? Like, what's that going to be like?
There is no plan. I mean, there is a attrition. It's probably like a third, but like 30 down to 20. And some people will eventually join me in Chicago, but we'll try to keep a small team in the end.
Sure. Yeah, those ones are tough. Like I feel like the geographic one is really difficult to address.
I think it would be easier if the housing market was better, but a lot of people have houses and trying to sell them, you're kind of stuck.
Right.
So,
that makes sense.
Is there anybody from the mothership that's willing to go out to the more office and spend some time on that kind of responsibility?
There are some people that lower level people, I guess, that they don't think want the opportunity to
move
because they're in Chicago. Like, why would you move to Chicago? It's all moving. Maybe all before that, we know that's not happening.
How big is the?
So we were about 30, they were about 220, so it's not like 250.
That's awesome.
Yes.
What was the intent to keep that really a viable, vibrant office?
It's going to be a tech team, and we'll see what our lease for space ends in November. Yes. We'll see what happens. With our
here. How much can you talk about your geographic setup?
I can talk about all that. I guess we just launched a new company yesterday, I guess, but through two acquisitions, we're in five cities. And the way we want to do that is by moving people, by making it very easy for people from one part of the organization to voluntarily move to another part of the organization. You have to have interest in enough places that people want to go to. Singapore is a big thing.
We do business across a number of cities too, and I actually haven't found the geography to be that much of a problem, but we had a reasonably distributed team before we got started, so that's part of our culture already.
But that was really hurtful for us, but we were a totally co-located team. We were the organization now I have 4,500 people that was used to working distributed. None of us still know how to distribute.
We talked to Matt at WordPress. They build their organization as a distributed organization, and they all the skills and tools in place to do that. But somebody else tries it, it completely fails. And it seems like it's a skill.
It's not something that we just culturally change. And then part of what we're trying to do is still have those individual offices as an individual flavor, and not most of the collaboration is within one of the units, not distributed. But it's a tough.
And that's just cultural fit. I mean, that's one aspect of culture. There's some companies that, Google's one that likes everyone in one place.
Sure.
And there's companies like HP that says, let's have everyone on. Right? It's a culture.
Well, the thing is, they built up, there's a selection bias who goes to work there. If you don't have that, if people don't want to work that way, and then they're going to live now in an environment that works in a different way, you're going to lose people.
We also had trouble with travel budgets.
Yes.
They were like, your travel budget doesn't allow you to go down to back and forth.
Right. Yeah. And those kinds of places where it's clear there wasn't planning as to how we could actually collaborate together.
Right.
cases where that acquisition was actually like a challenge, right? You're confused, right? Because clearly you didn't want all the team to leave, but you created a system by which they can actually participate.
Right. And they certainly don't feel like part of the team.
Yeah. When they take a look at the talent, it's the individual talent and not the team talent. Yeah. Destroy the team and try to liberate people that they think are. The team is composed of more than just the actual individuals. It should act as a team.
So when we were setting up, I noticed that there were a bunch of people in the room who were sort of considering acquisition. They were either teetering on the brink of, gosh, I might want to consider this for my company either now or in the future. But there were a fair number of people who had been through an acquisition, either on the going out and grabbing something and buying it side, or had just sort of lived through it. I'm curious if there are specific questions people have, because it's a great blend of both sides of that equation, and that's relatively rare when it's not the equation that you're trying to make work, and that's maybe more difficult one to ask. Yeah.
I have a question. So Ben and I both came from the dark side. We used to work in Microsoft, and we didn't love it, so we started a company. We did well enough that we no longer needed to work in the real sense of working, right? We'd work like 5 to 10 minutes a month, but that was kind of it. So we got bored after a year. We're like, well, what do we do? Well, we incubate. It's the obvious answer. So, you know, we started creating products, we started developing a reputation, and people, typically older white gentlemen with lots of money, approach us and say, why don't we start a company together? We'll set it up entrepreneurial T-ball style, I've got a friend, we'll buy it, and it'll be all good. And, you know, we really consider this, but we keep coming to the same conclusion, having worked at Microsoft and having met quite a few people who worked at Microsoft via acquisition, anything that you believe in seems to just get killed. Does anybody have a formula for how to take a project you actually care about and continue to see it live after it's acquired in a large company? I mean, you said like 9 out of 10 of these passion projects get annihilated. I mean, I've seen it in Microsoft countless times. How do you get to live beyond acquisition?
So to be fair, the most recent acquisition that
I
was a part of my company, the company that I worked for was acquired by eBay Vietnam. And in that case, it was a talent acquisition, and our baby was developing mobile applications for the world's best companies. And so it was a perfect fit because we're now developing the mobile applications that sell more product than any other mobile application in the world, including Amazon. So we sort of got to keep doing the same thing that we really love doing, just being out there and connecting people. But that fit doesn't always happen. In fact, it usually doesn't.
It's just a shoot of the dice, you're kind of hoping for the best.
For me, it's determining whether or not, I mean, my boss could have chosen to take the money or not take the money out of the company. And he chose to take the money in this case because he thought it would work, but there are many situations where if I was in his shoes, that would.
I mean, it doesn't feel like it's random,
right?
This gets back to vision, right? Like, if the visions aren't aligned, if you really can't see a way to align them, you know, I think there are way more acquisitions that happen than should.
That's right.
Right.
So this is sort of a weird question, but are there any reasons you guys have heard about acquisitions happening outside of money? This is a great cultural fit.
I think that's the best place to start, right? What is the bigger thing? What does the sum of parts look like? Like when you take, you know, big parent company, I mean, in our case, we're a small parent company, we're acquiring a couple of smaller companies, but what is the vision for what this company plus this company is going to produce bigger than what either company is doing before? And is it actually strategic? Is it actually important? I mean, it sounds like Zach's case was sort of like, oh, that's a nice little P&L that we can buy and operate. But there was no question like, well, how does this make parent company?
The funny thing is, in the last like 3 weeks, it's come out that what they wanted us to do is to go out and teach the organization about how we do what we do. But no,
that would have been good to tell.
I think that's actually a really important point. There are very different attitudes to go into different reasons to go into an acquisition, but their attitudes go into it. So a lot of acquisitions are like talent plays. And the goal there is to bring the people and the team into the core of the business in some manner, right? And those are just, you're not going to have, I don't think you're going to have a lot of room to deviate from the master plan. There's just any more than they already allow, right?
It seems that most talent acquisitions are pretty upfront about that. That the value.
Well, but okay, let's say there's a spectrum. There's the pure talent,
right,
to be acquired.
Acquired?
Yeah, you can't say it. I just learned that.
Yeah,
exactly. And then you've got companies which are intended to fit in like a Lego piece to the existing core of the business in some way. Were you guys like that?
MetaWeb was very much, so MetaWeb is almost a kind of counterexample of everything that we talked about, right? Like it was a situation where the company really wouldn't have been able to realize on its own. And well, those are great tools. Yeah, it took, I don't think that there's another company that could have done it honestly successfully. And I can think of maybe three or four that could have tried.
Right. Well, you can argue that YouTube was kind of similar.
Absolutely.
Right. Well, legal and cost.
And
then there are the these acquisitions, maybe like yours, which are kind of on the edge of interest in the business. And the business, the core wants to move towards the edge. And so here, from an architecting success standpoint, it's critical to build that in, right? That this edge business is preserved in some form. It doesn't necessarily have to be a central office, but that separateness in some form has to be important.
Well, the value has to be.
That's what
ends up failing all the time. You look at what somebody's doing and say that you buy it because it's awesome what you're doing, and then you bring it into your culture and you say, now you have to do it,
Well, in your case, like it sounds like if somebody had said to you, hi, we want you guys to be disruptive.
Yeah.
Right.
Knowing that you could have totally changed your angle with it. And this is kind of what we're talking about with getting rid of the mystery, right? Mm-hmm. Why did you bring us in, right? You should be able to answer that question really, really well. And if you can't, like, you need to demand that before the deal is kind of done.
And I think that employees who are part of an acquired company should demand that of the leaders.
Absolutely. Yeah. Everybody has a responsibility in these cases, right? So it's, and you know, this is another place where I feel like our acquisition went well, right? They actually said to us, hi, we really need you to be disruptive. You are approaching this problem from a completely different direction, and we need that vision, right? So, you know, I think if you can't get to a point where you can, you know, between you as you're negotiating the deal, like understand what this is gonna be that you're gonna articulate, like it's
probably not a good deal. Isn't that with an easy take though. I mean, one of the problems with our acquisition was we had already been building a large number of the acquisitions as a contract company. When we joined the company, pretty much John Donahoe, the CEO, said all mobile apps will go through them now. So all of the other 30 teams who had been developing mobile apps were like, who the hell are these guys?
Right.
And that was really unsettling and uncomfortable, and there were a lot of people who were working against that. And I could see why. I mean, now we've come to a point where we're the best practice and we work with other teams, but there's still a little bit of tension there.
Sure.
Yeah. Well, that's important in how the introduction of the new, like, bring a new family. you don't want to favor the new family, you want to figure out how to deal with it. And then, yeah, so to say, if you were asked to be disrupted, really, if you're now mentoring, you know, what the best practices it could have been an opportunity. It could have been something like, we're going to acquire this really talented organization. We want you to all learn from this.
Infuse our company with what they already know.
Yeah.
Right.
It wasn't
presented.
No.
Well, it's always tricky, right? Because, you know, in the meetings that you've had before this acquisition happened, you guys are the greatest company of all time, right?
That's a great point. That's a really good point.
It's really difficult to shift your story to, you guys are the greatest company of all time, but these guys have been doing this better, and you need to listen to them, right? Like, that's a really hard thing to say. We have to say hard things if we're going to do it. And that's, I guess that's kind of what made me excited about this talk, right? Is like, this is a really hard problem, and not talking about it at all doesn't make it easier, right? And it really feels like
it makes it seem easier.
It really feels like there needs to be more transparency, kind of at all levels in the process. It really seems like this model is going to be something that we're looking at more and more and more of. Right?
So. One of the big problems that you could mention, I think, is the people who've been the pieces to company.
Yeah.
Not the management who's decided to buy you.
Right.
Rank and file.
Yeah.
I had a company that was acquired by another company, and we became the golden shovel for the CEO. Yeah. You were the future of the business.
Yeah.
And the CEO actually told people, this is the future. And then everybody else...
Wow, you were the popular kids at lunch. You were the popular kids at lunch.
Yeah, exactly, for a while. Until they had a new acquisition, or a new startup, internal startup. The point really, though, was that he undermined our ability to be successful inadvertently by telling everybody that we are the golden children.
How could that have been done differently? Like, what would have made it possible for you to be the golden children without alienating everybody there?
Mm-hmm.
know, that really good gold control control by example, you know, like you don't have to tell people.
Right.
And awesome. Really okay, I'm awesome.
Right, right. That's the other system, not awesome.
I'm not saying sure that's true. I mean, you acquire a big company, and the people who've got a lot of big company ways, they're not that it's doing things. Acquiring, okay, can you teach the rest of your company stuff?
Well, if you're coming in to be disruptive, that's a little bit.
Well, tell what you're saying, right? You require to be.
So it was a product design company. You know, they built the business on industrial design. We were digital media in the 90s. And he was right, but what we did anyway was the future of business. But it had to build on the success, on the platform that they'd already created, on the work that people within over 20 years had done. And so I think that the answer is that more work should have been done to make that point, to tie what you're doing.
I wonder what that work is, right? Like, what is that? I mean, that's really what's the heart of it, right?
Yeah.
And who can do that work, right? It really feels like, I feel like to some degree, there were individual people who did really well in the acquisition that I was a part of, who weren't necessarily in management, they weren't necessarily in the places in the group where they should have been able to do this, but they kind of took initiative and they kind of, you know, met other people in the company who weren't necessarily part of the acquisition, but were the people who were what it took to make it work and make it strong, right? So this is why I kind of get back to like individual responsibility. Like even if you've been right in front of employees, there's stuff you can do to make this better, right? But we don't really talk about that much, so.
I feel like maybe an overarching theme to like the last four people you've shared might be something along the lines of, if there's a shift in how power is going to be distributed, it's going to be tricky. Like, it's going to feel funny. It's going to feel funny to the people that you say, hey, guess what? You have a whole bunch more power, like Amy's team or maybe even like Thor's team, who were the golden children. And it's going to feel awful to the people who've been doing a great job, and suddenly the CEO says, ooh, the future is them, or they're in charge of this. And whether it's like you guys feel like you came in and you don't have much power and you don't really know what's happening, or whether it's like you two, where suddenly you have a lot of power and the original team's going, what? Both of those situations really need a lot of finesse.
Yeah.
They're not something that you can just come in and say, slam, here's the new way that it is.
Well, and a shift of power is inevitable, right? Because it's either happening for the company that's acquiring, or it's happening for the company that's been acquired. Right?
Yeah, I was going to say that maybe the shift in power isn't usually planned, but it should have been. Yeah. Because there has to be a shift in power when you make that decision.
Well, you have to acknowledge it. I mean, you can't sort of sweep it under the rug. I think it's where a lot of these problems come up. It's like, that's going to be fine, but it's actually not going to be fine.
Yeah. So the next year, it's
going to
stop that.
Right, and by the way, you're losing your job because you're not somebody else's.
Right.
Yeah.
But I never, in fact, I've never heard anybody say, I don't think power is a good
diligence
or other time, anybody talk about how will this work for a manager. So I think that's an interesting point that
we surfaced.
Has
anybody had that? Like, we do that very seriously, because I don't think we'd be successful doing this. Pretty certainly. You still don't have risks, but the biggest one to manage is like, how is this operationally happening in the company, whether it's culture or the company.
Yeah, it's a communication, but they're all communication points. And so I work at a mid-sized company as an acquirer, and we've had those conversations before where we say, what do we want an org structure to look like, or informally, just how people want to work together. And we've had some deals, particularly the talent deals, where we say, we don't know what it's going to be like when they get aboard. So it's just kind of inappropriate for us to reassign reporting duties or try to figure out who's going to develop what products. We say, let's get these people on board, encourage them to keep doing what they've been doing, like really, for 2 months, and let them have their own mini company inside of ours. We're slowly going to expose them to some of the dependencies they'll have throughout the organization, all that, and see what emerges. But it's, if you're not actively communicating the whole time with the target, with the other people that you're working with, it's hard to make it work. And there's no, not just a bullet to make it work. It's,
right.
And
in terms of what you start to do after that 2 month period, like are there processes that you figured out that seem more successful for starting to do that shift?
It's I think we're in an interesting spot. My company is $200 million in revenue, so we're a mid-sized acquirer. We're not a Google, we're not a Microsoft that will just crush things like a bug.
Sure.
And we're people focused. Like there's no it's no good established processes for doing what we do here. If I need to figure out what a cost center somebody's going to hit, I just have to, there's two people I can ask that help you answer that question. So it's really, who do you ask which questions to? And trying to communicate that is a challenge for us. So we need to, like, instead of being in the team of six you previously worked in, now you're, there's a company of 1,000 people, there's 40 that are relevant to your job, some actively, some passively. So it's, we have all hands meetings to communicate strategy, make sure the whole comes on the same page. We visit functional group by functional group to help people feel comfortable about what the plans are, how it impacts them personally. We do it with the target, without the target, so people can drive conversation with them, to be able to ask questions without them being around, and just as much conversation as you possibly have, I guess, is what we try to do.
So, I mean, it sounds like you're actively spending a lot of time having a conversation with this specific
Yes.
Which, even in my relative view, I consider successful activity, there was very little of that, right? It was already a general block strategy, not sort of specific.
Never
with an
idea to acquire and not integrate.
Yeah.
Like, it's what you really want is the gem of the technology that this third party company has, and you don't want any of your competitors to have it. It's a devouring strategy to just buy that company and not integrate them into it all, and then continue to do what it is you think that they're doing great.
I would say you're doing it.
Are they really separate within?
Sure. I think Salesforce is doing that.
Yeah, they're pretty separate from Salesforce.
You keep a core team within a core team, even though you're buying technology.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, there's also buy a company for technology, kill off the technology, the license, of course, once you have it.
Right. The defensive.
Yeah.
That's the opposite.
Buy the key or buy the key.
Right.
Those
are two different. Right. Success is defined very differently.
Right.
Yeah, I feel like that brand of acquisition is a different thing. Like, yeah. you're clearly not.
But it does happen.
Oh yeah, absolutely. But you're not selecting for happiness there, right?
Yeah.
Well, you would think that I'm not good at an acquisition, but you would think that the acquiring company and the company that's being acquired would want to take this route.
Sure.
Not dissatisfied.
Right.
I mean, so if that's the plan, there's nobody in front of them.
Yeah, yeah.
How do you feel about your company sort of ceasing to exist now that it's part of Google, like the company you built, brand is gone? And
so I don't think we ever really were great at telling our story. So I don't actually feel like there was an amazing brand that we lost. The idea was kind of big and hard to wrap your head around. So I feel less bad about that than I think I would in many other.
Because I'm sort of, like, we started in 1997.
Oh, yeah.
Wednesday, we started transitioning people over, so
sure.
In a few months, we'll sort of cease to
have a
set anymore, so.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, even if your acquisition goes perfectly, right, that's
but that was part of the plan. It was more of a merger to kind of stop competing, or, like, we're in the online food space, and there's no real big company yet, so we want to kind of roll up and maybe make something big in the U.S. So rather than just competing with each other, let's just sort of work together and not waste our money trying to fight each other in a couple cities.
Sure. And they had a starter brand?
Yes. In Chicago, New York.
Yeah. Well, that brings up another really interesting point, which is does the acquired company get to keep its brand?
Yeah.
And what happens with the brand over time? So eBay's acquired 40 companies in the last 5 years, and I guess we've got a whole monopoly of brands. I mean, many of them you know, PayPal and StubHub and Milo, but a whole bunch of them we don't know. And the tiny little company that I was part of that was acquired still keeps its brand on our offices.
Yeah.
But that's kind of silly, right? I don't know what happens with all those brands over time.
It's silly, but at the same time, having that like cohesion and being able to
get
together
for
one thing, right? Yeah. Things like that. Like, I think there are little soft things like that that you can do. You know, almost independently, like we get together, once a month. Yeah, and it was a brand by the way, right? That it wasn't, hey, we're going to do this as a thing. We like each other, let's hang out. I think those little things can actually be unbelievably helpful for keeping happiness going.
I think what you're speaking to is the issue of identity.
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
That especially as a co-founder, but even as an early team member, a huge amount of your identity is wrapped up in your company.
Yeah.
You know, it's your logo. It's who you say you are. You say, hi, I'm so-and-so from this and that. And everyone knows you as that, and you feel great about it. And so having it suddenly be tossed away feels awful. And so figuring out, do you get to keep the brand? If you don't get to keep the brand, how does your identity shift, and how can you maybe talk about it? Like, I'd be really curious if there are
issues with, like, us versus them. Like, we're trying not to do that. So when I was switched to New York versus Chicago, which works only because we're geographically different, but it's still, like, I still catch myself saying the wrong thing. Like, no, it's not us versus, like, our way versus your way. It's all our way, because we're together now.
Like, I would be really curious if you guys have conversations about how your identity is changing. Like, it clearly is kind of changing out from under you, right? Like, you're not in total control over it. But for you guys to talk about, like, man, it used to be a certain way when we could all talk about this brand. And now that's changing.
I mean, so
what's it feel like?
We're trying to switch the brand over. We'll see how the consumers feel. And if they don't like it, we're going to go to Plan B, I guess.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, part of it is the customers of the company. When the company is acquired and it gets rolled in and integrated and all of a sudden my thing got lost. And that doesn't land for me as hard, but it probably would for a customer. But I'm talking about even the team. Like, how does it go for you guys to feel like, okay, your brand is disappearing? Is that okay? Is that poignant? Are you mourning it? Are you
I'm
having...
mourning it because I've been on a co-founder.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think some people, you know, have some attachment to it, but a lot of people have been there for 6 or 7 years.
You know, I'd be willing to bet that almost everybody at your company is mourning in some way the loss of that brand, the fact that it's going away. And if you'd be willing to have a conversation about that and actually bring everybody together and go, this is a poignant moment. Like, we've gained a lot, but we've really lost something. It's almost like going to a funeral.
We like, if you never... With everybody's name on them, you know, it was like, it's with the logo in the center, and it's just like, and how little, you know, get together around it. It was a nice little kind of pass off. I like that view.
Yeah.
We're doing a graduation because we were in the college market, so we're saying everyone graduated.
Oh, that's good. Yeah.
It's
awesome. That's positive. A lot more positive.
It's not a funeral. It's a success, I guess.
It's a New York,
Chicago. Well, I think this is great. The brand that you're merging into has to feel like a win for everybody, for the customer, for the rank and file, but also for the founders. Like, hopefully you're building something. The reason that you're merging your company with another company is to build something bigger, to build something better.
It took me probably a year before I stopped referring to people as today, though, right?
Yeah, that was like 6 months and we're still doing
really difficult, right?
It's been over a year for me or something.
You still do it? It's like, it probably just never goes away, that name.
I don't know. I think it all depends on how to manage it. Jim, you're saying you're not working on that website.
No.
The
no.
Problem, I mean, there isn't an us versus that thing.
Right.
Just working on stuff, that's cool.
Yeah. And that transition probably happened faster.
James, what are the things that helped you make it faster?
So a big part of it was just feeling a level of personal responsibility for it, right? I'm not a founder, and was on the design side, right? So I actually just, you know, I had no responsibility for the acquisition, but at the same time, I can start to see who's strong on teams and get a sense for who's going to be the best people to kind of connect. And doing what I could to connect people on my team, the team being acquired with the Google team, right? And really kind of put people in the same room who had something to share.
So you acted as glue a little bit.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I think that that made it much easier for me, right? That having that activity to do, right? Having something to do around bringing us together. I feel like everybody can kind of do that. Like, I feel like a lot of the people that working with felt like they couldn't do anything. Like they had no ability to impact us. Like the acquisition was something that was happening to them, right? As opposed to something that they were actively participating in. I think you know, part of that is how good the company doing the acquiring sets the stage. But I think another part of it is how much you decide you can influence it, right? And I think we can all influence a lot more than we think we can. And that helps a lot.
Right. So after the acquisition, suddenly it was like, do you think we can keep doing this?
Yeah.
So
saw a lot of the people on my team doing that, and it's for whatever reason did the opposite. And, I took people at their word that they wanted us to be disruptive and really, saw it as an opportunity.
Yeah, that's the approach we're taking. It's easier to ask for forgiveness than permission.
Yeah,
that's the way we're going.
Well, and hopefully the company that acquired the team did that because they wanted what you do. So
hopefully
there's a reason. There should be alignment in there. And I don't know if it's always true. I think in your case, it was much more like, well, we don't really know what to do with you guys, so you stand over here. Oh, by the way, fix all this.
Not only that, but the first year is definitely a honeymoon period. So if you're going to do something disruptive, do it right now.
You should probably do more now.
Start off really, because what are they going to do? Fire you?
Right.
They just bought you, and they bought you for more and more just
I think that is absolutely true.
You put out your elbows and make enough space for yourself in the first couple of months, and eventually they get used to the fact that you're
just write a manifesto for acquired companies. And the rule number one should be break things.
Yeah. And make space for it, right?
Yeah.
Understand that that's going to happen. Understand that it's better if it's like that.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, that's over. It's not just some version that happens when you don't do that is actually much more instructive to the actual one that's going to the company.
How are we on time? Ten?
15.
Great.
Awesome. Yeah, based on what you guys said, I almost want the second manifesto line to be act without permission.
Yeah.
Or assume you have permission.
So you were saying that some of the folks you were talking to are like, they're considering acquisition, but they haven't.
It's either teetering on the edge or have considered some and passed on them because it felt like
that. Yeah, so is this scary or is this like,
we're a small web development shop and ad agency is looking to acquire us. So we're right at the considering it phase. We don't know how the deals even go down.
Really?
So that'd be my main question. So like, how do these deals even happen? What's the structure? How do you value your company?
Right.
Sure. And the answer for that question is very different for an agency than we ask for a technology buyer.
Or product buyer.
Often that way. I know when I sold my company back in the 90s, I was talking about, we have stock and a big earnout. Meaning that most of the value was in producing over the course of the next few years, right? And that really frames everything you do as well. Right? But your ability to go and break things really is subjugated to profit motive at that point. So I think it avoids a lot of the potential value of bringing in that kind of X factor to a business. And, that is very normal.
We didn't do an earnout because we fought not to do one. We weren't sure how we would integrate and whether that would affect the way we do business. So like, it has to be straight up stock or cash.
Well, it certainly protects. Usually you'll have a lower ceiling on your outcome with that. People are willing to give you more if you can prove it over time. But you know what you're going to get. Most of those earnouts don't even earn out.
Yeah, I have a secret weapon. If I were in your shoes, I would be thinking, this is a good deal now, but in 2 years from now, the deals are going to be better. And it would be difficult for me not to think about that, because the tighter the time market gets, the more valuable you and your company are.
Yeah, I think that's where we're at right now. This might not be right.
And I'm actually talking to you because I'm looking at a web development team to acquire, and I want to get them now before talent gets tighter. But they're not more valuable.
Yeah.
If there really is plus time to join the new thing, I think there's a lot of value, but I think our sort of thesis going in is that we can provide more pipeline to someone that can help us grow faster than they could otherwise. If not better rates, also there's other advantages that we can further we do fix our thing. Okay, when we look at revenue versus earnout, we're looking at, well, how reliable is this revenue projection? Like, we're perfectly willing to pay, we're willing to pay a premium for other companies. We're happy to pay cash for things that are pretty damn likely to be true. We're not going to take the bet that this
new management teams going to, the existing management teams might be able to grow this thing to well proportions that are not indicated by history. If they want to sign up for that, great, let's have an air around it that says, like, yeah, if you do that, great. We would love to pay twice as much for a company as three times as valuable. Okay, pretty simple.
So, does that help at all?
So, what is it?
There are two types of burnouts that I've run across. One is the time-based, the other is the
revenue.
You have to hit these numbers at least roughly this time, or when you hit this number, then you get this money. Mine was sort of time-based, 9, 12, 18 months.
And did that work for you?
Mine was kind of an odd case, but kind of.
Make sure that there's a milestone that you can actually hit in a certain amount of time and get everyone running towards that. But that sounds like it's more likely to have people actually end up by doing it, and it sets the stage right at the beginning for here's what we want you to do.
Well, this acquirer manages your risk. This thing you bought is going to work.
Yeah.
What's even better is we can extend that incentive to people in the existing organization.
Yes.
So they have an incentive.
Yeah, I think that's the problem with burnouts is that once you're integrated into an organization, you no longer have control of necessarily hitting those milestones. It's now a joint thing. So
you didn't give me the resources I need to hit my milestones.
Yeah, it gets tricky to do stuff like that. Yeah.
And I think things change so much in 18 months in most corporations that to try to make a goal that's a payout in 18 months based on a milestone, that milestone will be forgotten in 18 months.
Yeah.
That's
how we did it. We started doing that in Atheo. We're very small. We got bought by a very rich outfit with very deep pockets, and they got up to those milestones and then they turned around and said,
really?
And then walked away from the whole thing. And we were just scrambling like that.
Structured deal.
Yeah.
I mean, you shouldn't have that kind of exposure.
Well, I think binary internets are also bad. Like, I don't like that. Like, you must make this much revenue. There should be some sort of graduate transfer. Yeah.
But to this point, I mean, we lost control to deliver on a lot of stuff. From this and the culture, everything going in. We did all the due diligence. We all got along. We had a ring around our roses. Everybody's having a good time. We're all in the same direction. And then there was a one high moment right after the deal happened. Like, whoa, you know, that's great, what just happened? And we didn't know what was going on, and then before we knew it, you know, you're getting served papers, and you're like, wow, this is not how we saw that going down. So
I have heard stories like that before.
It's pretty brutal, so that's an
expensive
lesson to learn.
Go ahead.
Yeah, anything you do avoid that in the future?
Yeah.
You know, we're super young. It was the first time we ever did it, probably 4 or 5 years ago. We're all green, none of us, I have three partners, none of us had gone through anything like that. And the gentleman's company who bought us is Hugo Pickens, and he's got deep pockets and good lawyers. And when we drew up the contract, they drew up a contract that was really favorable to them. Our lawyer was not as good as theirs. And when that time came, it really felt like that was in the cards the whole time. And we got into a lawsuit. It really felt like that was their plan. Okay, we're going to set it up this way. If it doesn't work out, you know, we'll just file a lawsuit against them. These guys don't have the money to defend themselves. they'll walk, they'll gladly walk, which we did. I mean, this was going to happen. That's the worst thing I've ever done.
This is maybe the harder side of happiness, right?
No, that's fine. Like, I want to hear how that's supposed to go.
Yeah, but
I have the opposite experience, and it was an expensive lesson to learn, for sure, but we've said, it's like, you guys, we told people to go away. We've been an acquisition target now, and we keep having people come talk to us, and we're like,
you're
going to have to be, they're going to have to be perfect when they walk through the door to come get us, because right now we're just going to be there's no reason to.
Well, you don't ever have to be acquired, it's just a way to, hit that revenue target.
Yeah, to this point, you get the return you get from that.
No.
You get that money and get you to that next thing is the temptation. That's it as a founder. You're like, wow, if I just had, I don't know, inject little. I mean, even for small company, give me $250,000, and then give me $500,000, and then give me $2 million. By the time we get through all that money, we're going to be, we know the vision, but, it's nice.
Yeah. I think if you're trying to be happy in selling your company, it's really important to identify what you want. It's more complicated than you think, because if you are invested in your product and your product guy, and you want that to continue, you have to spend a lot of time talking to your buyer about what they should and what they're going to do, and really believe what they're telling you. There's a lot of sellers that want an exit because they're entrepreneurs that are financially focused, or they want to be written with a tech crunch or whatever it is. Like there's goals to sell a company.
Right.
And if that's the case, just acknowledge them. You'll be on board for a year, you'll do your next startup. There's a reason you're a startup in the first place. You're probably not a big company person.
Right.
That's okay. It's just kind of, you can't have all the things that you want, so you figure out what you're trying to get out of this and you're gonna focus on getting it.
Great. Any last question?
I just want to say how much I've enjoyed this panel, really. Literally, I haven't been through it. We're not planning on being acquired, but probably in the future, that is the plan, really, for the company. I've been with us since day one. No share options in the company as well. So that is kind of like the long-term aim of the company, really, is to kind of be acquired by being for a short day, really. So at least I've now got a few ideas about it.
I think Mace is a good point. Like some companies, they're wholly owned concerns about the founders, and you can make a living by cash flow. But when you start taking money from investors, professional investors in the startup space, they expect you to either cash out through an acquisition or go public, right? And precious few go public, which means that most companies from day one of taking that money aren't thinking about an acquisition. And
that's a really great point.
It creates some really weird psychology in a company. Somewhere in your mind, you're thinking, how am I going to sell this someday?
Sure.
Your employees are thinking the same thing.
Yeah.
So I don't know if this will be a statement or a question. But
well, it's all fine if we would say, well, most acquisitions probably shouldn't happen, but the primary means by which things get funded is an expectation of acquisition. That's not a very healthy thing to say, because I think that's bad.
Yeah, exactly. And so, the points that were made about understanding not just what's going to make you happy in an acquisition, but how do you build a business that can't withstand the digestive tract of
multinational I don't know if you guys have found this to be true, but I've never had a company basically acknowledge that, right? No CEO is going to get up in front of you and talk about, here's what we're currently thinking about in terms of acquisition that could happen anywhere from 6 months from now to 3 years from now. But that's happening all the time, right? They're working on that all the time. And obviously it's really hard to share that, but I feel like there's something you can do, right? You need to be more open about that as a cycle, especially for young people. There are a lot of young technologists, right?
Yep.
Have no business sense at all of their own stuff. When you sign on as a startup, you're
pretty much all of us when we first started.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, this isn't information we get from somewhere else, but it's these kinds of conversations and going through it and sources for them.
In this whole conversation, I haven't heard anybody mention what's probably the most important thing to having a happy acquisition. That's really starting off right. So I